Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
And it is a wall of flame. Fire erupting everywhere. Chicken burned beyond recognition. And now I've got to go turn it. You know, I've got to kill a burner. I've got to lower the other burners. And I'm angry. And I'm angry because I'm doing this right in the middle of a thunderstorm. I'm soaking wet. I'm turning burnt chicken.
Well, the rain will help the grease fire.
And I'm really, really angry. And I'm angry at no one but myself. And I do turn to people in my house and I say the following. Don't say it. Don't say a word.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
I enjoyed telling that story. I hope people enjoyed hearing that story. What I enjoy equally, if not more, is the ability to open this show and talk about sports. And I've got the ability today to recreate the show that we used to do, sadly without the regulars here, other than Michael, who's 6 feet away on Uncle Benny's table. And I hope, Michael, when you woke up this morning, I hope you looked into the southwestern sky and saw one day after the full moon, an almost full moon. It's beautiful. Did you see it?
Can't believe I missed it.
Oh, it was really beautiful. Sean is in New York. Nigel is in New York working at the U.S. Open. And he said we can talk to him about it anytime we want. Well, I don't want to yet. So I want to talk about three things that happened yesterday in sports. The first one I'll just get rid of quickly. That is the hiring of Steve Nash by the Brooklyn Nets to coach Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and win a championship, because they will be assumed to be championship contenders, particularly in the Eastern Conference, next year. If you gave me 100 chances to guess who would coach the Nets, I would never have come up with Steve Nash. And Steve Nash was a great player, a two-time MVP. But the last time we saw Steve Nash, he was talking, analyzing European soccer on TV. European soccer. I had no idea he wanted to coach. Do I think it's a good choice? Don't know. Don't know. There have been a couple of people who have never coached before, ever once, and they've been terrific. Larry Bird is one of them. He only coached 3 years because he didn't particularly like coaching. He took over a 39-win team. He won 51 the first year. He went to the Eastern Conference Finals the first year, the second year, and the NBA Finals the third year. He was great. Steve Kerr had never coached before. He took over a 51-win team and won 67 and a championship in his first year. He was great. Magic Johnson had never coached before. About 10 games in, he said, you know what? I don't like it. I don't want to do it anymore. That's what I would worry about with Steve Nash. I'd worry about Kyrie Irving sabotaging him, because Kyrie Irving is poisonous. But somebody's got to coach that team. Wilbon and everybody else talked about Greg Popovich, which I never thought would happen, and obviously didn't happen, because if Greg Popovich wanted to coach that team, they would have hired him without question, because he's got, hello, five championships. Anywhere Greg Popovich wants to work, you fire the guy you've got and you hire Greg Popovich, but he clearly didn't want to do it. That's story number one. I know Steve Nash a little bit. He's a gregarious guy. I wish him all the luck in the world. Wilbon loves him, adores Steve Nash. It's a quick little story one time. It's my one Steve Nash story. 8, 10 years ago, whenever it was, I took a friend of mine, Carrie Stevens, out to dinner in Washington at Equinox, Todd Gray's place, Equinox. And Carrie has lived in Canada for like 40 years and raised his family in Canada. He's a clinical psychologist in Canada. He was in the United States because he was coordinating something between Canada Homeland Security and the United States Homeland Security. So he was here on business. And we were sitting down and Steve Nash walked over to the table. I guess the Suns were in, either the Suns or the Lakers, and he was eating at the same restaurant. And he walked over and said hello and sat down with us for a little while. I was tickled because I like Steve Nash, and I just thought, wow, isn't this nice that an athlete would come over and say hello? And Carrie, because he's Canadian basically at this point in his life, spent more time in Canada than in the United States, was thrilled because Steve Nash is Canadian. He's from Western Canada, and Carrie lives, I believe, in Ottawa, in the capital of Canada. But it was just thrilling. I remember that because Steve Nash was so gracious to just come over and sit for a while. So I wish him all the luck in the world. That's story one. Story two is I'm going to talk a little bit about Tom Seaver. I'm not going to talk a lot about Tom Seaver. I did this yesterday on PTI. But the Mets were the team of my youth, and Tom Seaver is the pitcher of my life. Tom Seaver is the greatest player by far to wear the blue and orange of the New York Metropolitan Baseball Club. He was Rookie of the Year in 1967 when he won 16 games. I don't think anybody ever on the Mets had won anywhere close to that. The Mets started in 1962. For the first 7 years of their existence, they finished last six times and next to last once. And then in the next year, with Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman leading the way, they won the World Series. They're the most likely World Series champion ever. They're the amazing Mets and the Miracle Mets. And that year I was in college, and I watched every single Mets game I could on Channel 9 in New York and went to every single game at Shea that I could, probably 10, 12 games at Shea. I was there the first night they ever went into first place. Love the Mets. Love Tom Seaver. Later on, because I was a sports writer and I was around Tom Seaver, I never said a word to him about this. But, you know, it was always nice. He was personable. He was smart. When I worked at the New York Times, the baseball writer for the Mets was a guy named Joe Durso. And Joe Durso was so tickled with the fact that he would go into the Mets clubhouse and Seaver would be doing the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle. This was a great mark of honor for the New York Times that Seaver, probably alone in the clubhouse as everybody else was eating and drinking, Seaver would be off by himself doing this. And he was not a loner. He was thought of as a leader on the team. He had a great, his career is fantastic. There are two people in the history of baseball who have won more than 300 games, have recorded more than 3,000 strikeouts, and have a sub-300 ERA. Two people. Tom Seaver, Walter Johnson. That's it. That's the list. You like that company? Tom Seaver, Walter Johnson. I don't have to tell you everything he did. You know what he's done. But the notion last year that Tom Brady tried to patent the name. Do you remember this, Nigel? Because Brady's your boy. Do you remember this when he tried to patent the name Tom Terrific? And I went crazy on the air. So hold on a second. Hold on a second, Sparky. Yeah. There is a Tom Terrific. He's Tom Seaver. You're not Tom Terrific. Nobody else named Tom is Tom Terrific. Tom Seaver is Tom Terrific, so back off. Right? That's what I basically said. I may have been word for word what I said. Seaver was just great. When he was elected to the Hall of Fame at that point, he has been surpassed since by Ken Griffey Jr. and Mariano Rivera, I believe. But he had the highest percentage of votes ever, positive votes, for the Hall of Fame at that point. And totally well-deserved. He suffered in recent years from dementia. And you know, and everybody sort of knew that his life was not going to be as long-lived as they hoped. And he died, I guess, today is Friday, I guess Wednesday evening, maybe something like that. And he was the greatest player, greatest pitcher. His only peers as a pitcher in the, you know, the 15 years of his career. He lasted 20, but the 15 great years, most of which were spent with the Mets, but not all. He was with the White Sox and the Reds, and Red Sox even. His peers were Steve Carlton and Jim Palmer. And Jim Palmer the other day went on social media to say that Tom Seaver was the best of them. And that's, Jim Palmer can be egotistical, as you know, if you watch the games. I really like Jim Palmer, but Jim Palmer does not suffer fools. He's every bit as smart as Tom Seaver, if not smarter. And if he says Tom Seaver was the best of them, I think you can go to the bank on that. So I wanted to mention that with Tom Seaver. And now I want to get to the thing that drove me crazy last night, which was the Nats. The Nats went behind early. Anibal Sanchez, who's had one good start this year, right, Michael? One good start.
Yeah, maybe one.
Maybe one good start. Had another bad start. And they had to hook him pretty early. And they had to go to the bullpen in the third, maybe, or the fourth. Okay,
three,
and they were down.
3-3.
Down 4-0, down 4-2.
They were down 4-2. Trey Turner had a little inside, league home run right, to tie the game. And quickly, they gave up the lead.
Right. So, and they're always behind. So they go to the bullpen. I pick up the game in the eighth. They're ahead 5-4 in the eighth. And they bring on Will Harris. And I begin a series of texts to my son and to Chris Saliza and to anybody else who I think is paying attention.
Somehow Kaliza has made it into our father-son text chain. I don't know how.
All the time. And I say, this is going to be bad. And immediately, Will Harris, who has not pitched well at all for the Nats, not at all, Will Harris loads up the bases with one out. First guy, single, and he loads up the bases.
Single
one
off his shoe. The thing that's single truly off Will terrible Harris. Is he's afraid to pitch to Jay Bruce, who is a strikeout home run guy. pound the zone and get an out, and you can't walk him.
So it's you got three on and one out, and they bring in Daniel Hudson. Daniel Hudson does his job.
Gets the ground ball.
He gets a one bouncer, but you can't turn a double play. It's too slowly hit, so the run comes in and ties the game. Daniel Hudson in the next inning, as afraid as I am, is great. In the bottom of the ninth, he's great.
Great against the heart.
The heart of the lineup. Now, let me tell you what the Nats are doing at this point. In the eighth inning, they strike out three times. Right? In the eighth inning, they give you Garcia.
Robles.
They give you Robles, who can't hit at all. Can't swing. Can't hit at all. And Michael Kay. And he's out. Okay.
To be fair, Michael Kay got them the lead.
Yeah. Okay. But he's out.
Yes.
Strikes out. And then then it goes to the 10th with the runner on. And they got Michael Kay Taylor on second.
Yeah, he got fast. Some speed. He made the last out.
Now, you say to yourself, why wouldn't they bunt him along? Well, because Trey Turner's the best hitter they've got. You don't want to take the bat out of Trey Turner's hands. And Trey Turner then strikes out. Who comes up after Trey Turner? Because he then, Juan Soto?
Automatic walk.
He gets a walk. And then Asdrubal Cabrera strikes out. Strikes out. They eventually come to bases loaded. And they bring up Brock Holt, who is much smaller than somebody named Brock ought to be. And Brock Holt.
Rockstar.
Yeah, Brock Holt hits a one bouncer to first, and they're out of the inning.
Time to shave the mustache.
And then in the bottom of the 10th, runner on second base, J.L. Realmuto. Is it J.L.? What's his?
J.T.
J.T. Realmuto.
Catcher good, who can run.
Real good runner for a catcher. That's all I'll say. The Beltway Mitterrand comes in. And the first batter up is Didi Gregorius. And he has a very bad bunt attempt on the first pitch. And F.P. Santangelo, crowing like a rooster, says, he doesn't know how to bunt. It's pretty obvious. He was uncomfortable bunting, and Joe Girardi should know that because he managed him at the Yankees. The next bunt attempt is the most perfect bunt attempt in the history of bunting. It is a two-bounce bunt attempt
on a slow
to
field
first base.
That you can't even let it try and go foul.
Nothing. Yeah, there's nothing you can do except throw the guy out at first, advancing the runner to third. Eventually, people are walked, and eventually it's one out, and base is loaded, and boom, hits a sacrifice fly, and it's to center field, and Robles has the best arm, and FP then criticizes him because he wasn't running in, except when you watch the replay, he is running
in. You must have not watched the Nats post game.
He is
because your boy was crushing how he wasn't set up to try and make the throw home. The game was over as soon as the ball's lifted anywhere
to
the outfield.
Yeah. So they lose the game. Now, this drives me nuts because I watch every single game. They're now the fourth worst record in all of baseball, or the third worst record in all of baseball. They're not going to make the playoffs. Look,
hey, but they get two automatic teams in. They still have a path.
They're not going to make the playoffs.
Let me just say this.
They're now 0-6 against the Phillies. If you don't think Bryce Harper's laughing as he parades in front of the mirror, as he's tried to make himself look like Jason Worth, he is laughing at the Nats. But I won't even go into that.
Do you think he's laughing at the ring?
He's not laughing at the ring. People will say that, and I will say this, the Nats got cheated out of their celebration, out of their walk through spring training and into the season. They did, because of the Astros and because of the virus. They did. But they didn't get cheated out of winning. They had that moment when they won. They had the reverie when they won and immediately thereafter. So we're not going to feel badly except in the sort of abstract. Davey Martinez the other day, I don't know what he said. I don't know what he said after last night. But after they lost the other night, Davey Martinez actually said these words. I'm not going to put any pressure on them. What? You're not going to put any pressure on them? That's your job. What you're doing to this point isn't working. You have to do something else to see if it works. You might want to say to the players, we're going to be hopelessly out of this if we continue to lose like this. Am I wrong on this?
No, you're not.
There
are different ways to apply pressure. And he always comes back to, let's go 1-0 today, or you can only start by winning today's game. But looking at every single Cabrera at bat, where he's trying to lift it out of the park, and it comes back to pitching. If you can't have Anibal Sanchez get through the fourth inning. And every time you try and chip away at the lead.
Fetty,
so you look at Davey manages yesterday's game to win in regulation. I mean, yes, Doolittle is not someone who's overpowering and getting a lot of strikeouts. The guy who can do that is the guy they had to go to, and I guess the sixth or seventh with Rainey, who's actually turning around. And the bullpen pitched a great middle of the game get it there.
Yes,
Wander Suero wandered his way into five really solid outs.
Yes.
So we can't be critical
they win?
There. They did not
win. Did the Beltway Mitterrand give it up?
Amazing that Hudson, because of the way baseball is scored, gets a blown save when he gets exactly what he needs. Yeah. And you look at the way the game ends. So, yes, the reason Bryce Harper should be laughing is he's doing everything that he needs to do, which is he's being under the radar, he's getting walked, he's getting singles, and he wasn't even doing, you know, Sports Center parade home runs to win this series and to get the sweep here. And you look at who's the guy that gets the... that gets the fly ball that ends up winning them. Boom. You talk about
Harper.
They have
a good lineup.
If you are a really Phillies fan, you should be really excited. I would be pumped to see them in a short series. But you look at Boom, a prospect, a third baseman, who you're seeing coming to his own. Where is our prospect at third?
Back in the minors.
Back in the minors.
Never coming back. Keboom's never coming back.
Always
they've given
looks
up
like
on him
trying
twice.
To fix his contact.
Just no good. Yeah. All right.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Have your new t-shirts arrived?
No. Okay. I don't want them.
Not even the cayenne shirt?
No, I don't like the idea of the colors. I got the wrong colors. I'm going to give them away.
More about that next week.
Yeah. Chuck Culpepper, what?
Can I pass along a message?
From who?
From Claude.
Yeah.
He texted me the last show. Hey, Nigel, it's a small world. Mel Krupin was mentioned on the show today. I know at work and play golf with his grandson, Stephen Krupin. He's a former speechwriter for President Obama and John Kerry, etc. And he's a huge fan of the show. So I just want to say
that makes me happy. Mel Krupin, of course, one of the great restaurateurs. You know, Mel Krupin, Duke Siebert. I mean, they're the two in Washington. Yeah, lovely. Thank you. Thank you for that. We will take a break. Chuck Culpepper will join us from the Kentucky Derby to talk about the Derby and to talk about the tennis. I think he's going to go back and cover that. I think I could be wrong, but we'll talk about both those things with Chuck Culpepper when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the Bespoke Post ad. As we all settle into this new normal version of summer, Bespoke Post is here with customized box of awesome collections for guys. Guaranteed to upgrade your life. Michael, what have you got? You've got stuff at home.
Yeah, sure. I do have the Dutch oven. I've got the cold brew carafe. But right now I'm in the outdoor section looking at knives and hatchets.
Hatchets.
Along with survival folding shovels. How about that for a trio? A field knife, Damascus backwoods camp axe, and a folding shovel. What are you getting up to this weekend?
I really like that. Bespoke Post only sends guys the best stuff every month, no matter what you're into. Obviously, if you're into survivalism, they'll send you that. Box of Awesome has you covered. From style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear, which we just mentioned, Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right Box of Awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up. You can skip a month. You can cancel anytime. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get 20% off your first monthly box. Get those things. Get that survival stuff. When you sign up at boxofawesome.com and you enter the code Tony at checkout, that's boxofawesome.com, code Tony for 20% off your first box, and use the code, people.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Don Stewart has sent us two songs today. And he writes, thank you so much for doing your podcast while the virus is causing so much trouble everywhere. My wife Marilyn and I look forward to every one of your shows, even though she only cares about the Yankees and the Nationals. I like to hear about everything, including the squirrels. I've attached a couple of songs I wrote, but you may not want to play them because they're sort of rock songs. I want to play them. This is called From Outer Space. He said he wrote it after he had a carotid endarterectomy last November. I don't even know what that is, but it doesn't sound great. When I got home, I looked in the mirror. It looked like the surgeon had put a big leech from outer space on my neck. If you listen to the song, you'll hear Marilyn singing the high part. Both songs are by Don Stewart today, and we're thrilled that he sends us his stuff. And he plays in Chuck Culpepper, who I believe is now, are you at the Kentucky Derby or near the Kentucky Derby? Will you get into the Kentucky Derby, or are you just going to stay in Lexington and, you know, and just stay at an overpriced hotel? I mean, what is the deal?
I am standing alone in section 322, high above Churchill Downs, watching the horses gallop by.
The Twin Spires. You can see the Twin Spires.
I'm under the Twin Spires, so I can't see them now, but I have already passed them today. They're in
for the
Kentucky Oaks Day.
Oh, yeah, because that's all Phillies. The Kentucky Oaks is all Phillies.
Right.
This is going to be scary for Culpepper because I've actually covered the Kentucky Derby. I actually like horse racing, unlike Wilbon, who just says, oh, look at the horse he's run. I actually like horse racing. So I have a series of three questions.
Oh, no.
And the first one is determinant. And it is, will there be fans? Will there be hats? Will there be juleps?
There will not. There will be none of that. And it's... of all the weird things you can see this year, and I have seen this year at various events, this is the weirdest because this event is all about the crowd, and it's all about, you know, trying to get in and trying to get out and seeing what people are wearing, and there will be none of that. They had hoped to have 14%, and then when the coronavirus cases spiked here, they had to scrap that plan. So
I, having covered the Derby a number of times, the Derby runs, it used to run at 5:40 Eastern time. Kentucky, I still think, is in the Eastern time zone. And it ran 5:40 Eastern time zone. It's the furthest Western state in the time zone. And we got there at 7 in the morning. And we were always told, if you try to get here after 8 in the morning, you're not getting in. You'll never get close. You'll never park. So we got there as early as we could. That was in May. It's always the first Saturday in May. This is so odd. I know what you're talking about with the fans. But not only is it not in May, it's not even the first race of the Triple Crown because they ran to Belmont. This must feel so dislocating to you.
Oh, it is like a reorientation of the brain waves or something like that. You know, it's 11 weeks after the Belmont. Not only that, but there's been the Traverse tucked in, which is a mile and a quarter at Saratoga on August the 8th. And so, you know, we always come to the Derby with that question, which horses will be able to handle the distance? Well, now we know that there's a few who ran in the Travers, including the winner, Tis the Law, who's the favorite here. So we know he can handle the distance. So that's entirely different as well. And yes, we'd be able to get here around 4 o'clock, you know, if you wanted to tomorrow, and it would be no problem.
Sure. So when you say we know that Tis the Law can handle the distance, Tis the Law won the Belmont at a mile and a half. They're going backwards this year, Chuck. They're going longest, mid-longest, shortest, because the Preakness is the shortest of the three. It's so odd. I don't get it.
No, except that they ran the Belmont at a mile and an eighth because it was the first one, and they didn't want to subject them to a mile and a half right off.
Thank you for that correction. Then, so there will be no mile and a half race. They won't run the Preakness.
Right.
Okay.
So
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That mile and a half factor becomes part of the discussion of, is it a real Triple Crown, you know, if Tis the Law were to win these last two races, you know, that'll be part of the discussion. Well, he never covered a mile and a half, so it can't be real. That'll be on the side of, no, it's not real. It needs an asterisk.
So my dear departed friend Bill Knack always used to refer to the classic distance of the Belmont at a mile and a half. And I think that people who love horse racing, they want to see you cover a mile and a half, you know, in the third race in 5 weeks, right? They want that.
Oh, yes, they do. And because it's the only one of its kind. So that's part of what makes it such an outsized achievement. And I loved Bill Knack, too.
Tremendous rider. Tremendous rider. I worked with him at Newsday just when we were both young. Tremendous rider. The Kentucky Derby is the race where everybody and his mom enters a horse if they can, so they had to cut it off at 20 one year. Sometimes the Belmont has as few as 5 or 6, but the Kentucky Derby always has near 20. And two gates. How many are entered this year?
Is it 17 full at this point?
Oh, so it's not full.
It was at 19 when we started the week, and it's down to 17 as of this moment. So,
did I read that Tis the Law is on the far outside?
He is. He is.
Is that good or bad?
I think it's seen anymore is not a big deal. You know, we've had horses come and win from out there enough times that it's seen as not that big of a deal. In fact, a lot of the what's perceived as the best quality in the race, you know, is out there at the edge. It's kind of funny. They're all out there. The lowest odds are all sort of out toward the end.
So my friend Eddie, who picks the Derby every year and sometimes wins and sometimes doesn't want Tis the Law because he doesn't want the price on Tis the Law. And he talked about a horse called New York Traffic. Are you familiar with that horse at all? Is that any good?
Well, I think part of the issue about, I don't bet, but I look at the betting. So part of the issue about betting this race is that, okay, so you do want to go beyond the price that's not going to get you anything for Tis the Law. But beyond that, you know, we had these horses like Nadal and Charlatan who won the two versions of the Arkansas Derby, and there was much excitement about the field in May, you know, and in before that in March, February. And there was a lot of excitement about this crop, and it was going to be really good. But those two horses that I mentioned, you know, got injured and couldn't continue, and a lot of that has faded away. So I find it really hard to pick one of the others. There's Honor AP, who won the Santa Anita Derby at, I think, 5-1 last I looked. But I find it really hard to look beyond Tis the Law and find something that kind of generates any enthusiasm. Maybe this Max Player, who ran the Travers against Tis the Law and had and finished third and had a you know, kind of a commendable finish to the race at a mile and a quarter. So maybe you could go for that.
I remember the Belmont. I remember Tis the Law drawing away at the end and being by far the best horse, which leads to this question. Assuming, you shouldn't assume these things because it hasn't happened that often, but assuming Tis the Law indeed wins all three, will you, as someone who chronicles this horse racing, will you consider him a legitimate Triple Crown winner?
I will, because it's going to be spread out over 16 weeks, I believe, 15 weeks, 15 weeks. I just think it's really hard to do. It's still really hard to do. It's, you know, it was the Belmont, granted, at the shorter distance, and then 11 weeks to this, and then 4 to the Preakness with the Travers tucked in there. I just think you had to, the trainer, Barkley Tagg, would have had to sustain a lot of fitness during that time. And I think that's a hard call. And I think it's a different kind of hard call, but I still think that's a hard task.
Thank you, by the way, for mentioning Nadal as a horse. It leads me into the U.S. Open, which is ongoing at the moment without Rafael Nadal, without Roger Federer. And in the same way that I have just asked you, is it a real Triple Crown? If Tis the Law wins this way, is it a real Open without them? If Djokovic wins, is it a real Open?
I think so. I hate to go all yes on both of those, but I'm going all yes on both of those. I think it's still real. I think it has its own set of challenges. Again, they're different from the normal challenges, but I think it's all the oddness, all the, you know, last night I was watching it and they had this deluge of a rainstorm there, and the sound of it was just so, you know, set against an empty stadium, was just so jarring, at least through the TV. I kept thinking about trying to play during that. And I think all these considerations about the bubble and everything kind of helped make it something that to win would be an achievement.
Can you tell me why I hate Djokovic so much? I cannot stand him. I actually root against him.
I have this hypothesis about why that might be. So,
go ahead.
For years we had, all right. So the sport has had these three people at the top who have really tried to be ambassadors, and so they've been beloved by the fans. Two of them have been beloved by the fans. Federer, maybe the most beloved athlete in the world. You know, if you write that he's 90% of himself, people just start to bombard you with, how dare you say that? You know, his fans defend him so mightily, you know, so there's, and then Nadal, who's one of the most gentlemanly people I've ever seen in sports, which, you know, is kind of strange because you'd love to see him in a greeting, but not on the other side of the court where it becomes a different story, you know. And then Djokovic, they're from Switzerland and Spain, two kind of settled countries. And two countries have been at peace for a good while. And here comes Djokovic from Serbia, and he's tried very hard to be an ambassador. And sometimes I think people think the way that he's tried is kind of awkward. He just tries so hard at it to be maybe a little bit like those other guys, and maybe they see a certain, I don't know, phoniness in that. I don't, but I can see where people see. I get those emails a lot of times, oh, he's such a phony, just because he's trying so hard.
Maybe I'm wrong on it, but I've always thought of him as sort of like Larry Holmes following Muhammad Ali. You know, that I just don't think he's in their class, but maybe he is, and maybe he will end up with the most majors of all. But I think you would probably agree that if he doesn't win this one, that will be very embarrassing, because the field is thin, right?
Well, if Medvedev won it after last year at the U.S. Open, where he took Nadal to five sets, an incredible match, and the crowd had been on him for 2 weeks, and then it got behind him and loved him, I think if Medvedev or maybe Dominic Thiem won this, I think we could forgive that.
I'll get you out of here on this. We did this yesterday on PTI. 2 days ago, we did it yesterday, but 2 days ago, Jimmy Connors was 68 years old. Mm. I remember Jimmy Connors vividly. He was at Forest Hills when he made his debut in the U.S. Open. I remember him as a very coarse, bullying person with just a killer mentality to just pound the ball as hard as he could, I think, with that Wilson T2000. And I have great fondness for the way he played tennis, more fondness than I do for him. Do you have any sense of him, or am I dating myself terribly? Like, where does Connors rank in your mind?
I almost could have said that word for word myself. He's probably one of my least favorite individuals among mm-hmm. the great players. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, there was a moment where you have to concede that the effort there. And remember that run in 1991 at age, what were we added up?
39. He was a werewolf at night, a werewolf. Yes.
Right. And the draw he went through maybe wasn't the toughest possible that time. And then Courier in the semifinal, you know, sort of just carved him up. But boy, that was something. And I think the whole 39 aspect of it. And one time in 89, he beat Stefan Edberg in the quarters, I want to say, or maybe the fourth round. And you know, that was astonishing, too, at 37. And he came in the press room, and first question was, how old are you? You know, and he kind of smiled because he liked the compliment. So, yeah, you have to hand it to – I put him in the you know, there was a time – you know, when he lost the 75 Wimbledon final to Arthur Ashe. Such a shocking upset because he was such a dominant figure. So he's up there in the pantheon.
See, I will never make the case that he's a better player than Sampras, but the case that I would make is among Sampras, McEnroe, Agassi, and Connors, who were the four best of the last 50 years in the United States, that if I had one match to play from my life, I'd pick Connors.
Oh, I'd pick Connors. Sampras, but I get it. Yeah.
As long as on hard court. I mean, on grass, I'm going to pick Sampras, clearly. You know, and clay, one of the other two. Anyway. All right, it's nice to talk with you. Enjoy the Derby. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me, always. Thank you.
Chuck Culpepper. A delight, right, Michael? Total delight. We'll take a break. We're going to come back with Ann Hornaday, who we haven't spoken to in a long time. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
As I said before, we have two songs by Dawn Stewart today. This one is called Trillion Eyes. It's just a rock love song. And he writes, thanks as always for playing my songs. I really still can't believe you play them when I hear all the great songs that other people send you. You send us great songs too. And Michael, if people like Dawn Stewart want to send us their songs, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheisershow.com.
Are we selling anything?
Yeah, go check out Johnny O. They have some new fall offerings, including the casual shoes that you've been wearing on PTI.
Every day.
Use promo code Uncle Benny.
Every day on PTI, I wear those gray loafers, gray penny loafers. Soft, nice, very nice shoes. Very nice. Ann Hornaday joins us now. And the first question that I wrote down last night was, long time no hear. Haven't heard from you because the industry that you are charged with covering pretty much shut down. What is, you know, and now you hear about phase threes and phase fours and phase fives, and you hear about the opening of theaters, and you wrote a piece today in the Washington Post that I'd like you to talk about. Just explain what happened with the opportunity to see a movie.
Yeah, I'm the movie is Tenet, which is probably the most highly anticipated film of the year, because while different studios and different filmmakers, you know, chose to survive the and navigate the pandemic in different ways, some by waiting, some by going directly to streaming. You know, Christopher Nolan has always been a really big advocate of the theatrical experience, to his credit, and both aesthetically and as a culture and as a business. And so it felt like he and Warner Brothers were always very clear that that movie would open in theaters when it opened. And so they kind of watched and waited, and they kept shifting the opening date, and they finally chose yesterday as their official opening date, by which time several theaters in the country had been cleared to open. They waited for that, obviously. They didn't want to, you know, put people in danger and force the issue. But where theaters are open, you know, they thought it was fair for to open. And the, as you know, the theaters in Virginia have been cleared to open, and so that is part of the Post subscription area. So we were invited to a press screening for the film a few weeks ago, and you know, that screening was offered according to all the rules: social distancing, masks. But I and my colleagues at the Post thought long and hard, and we still would have preferred and needed a safer alternative, which is a digital link, which is how we've been seeing most of our movies during this time. And that was not forthcoming. And so we decided as a team that we would decline the invitation to attend that screening. And it was real, it was agony. I mean, I was literally in physical pain as I made that decision. It was really, really tough. But here we are, you know, everybody's making their own individual decisions about how best to proceed. And that was ours. And I wrote about it today. And, you know, it was an incredibly painful piece to write. It was an agonizing decision and an agonizing story to write.
Do you think, or when do you think, you will go to the movies again? Because I'm sure you feel, as I feel, that the collective experience of going to a movie is better than seeing it at home. It's just better. It's always been better.
Hands down.
Always better. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, Tony, that's the question. I mean, I think that's what we are all faced with, is what constellation of conditions will have to be true in order to feel okay about walking into that indoor space. I mean, I'm still in a place where I am really limiting my indoor activities with other people to necessities, like medical appointments, which between myself and my family, we have a ton. And so, and then I still go to the store, but very, as rarely as possible, but I consider that a necessity. And so, you know, again, past those things, any kind of, discretionary indoor activity, I'm just not doing. And I'm not, I wouldn't go to a restaurant or, but you know, it's, but again, I'm not judging people who do, because they might have a different circumstance. You know, I mean, that might be where they spend their indoor budget. You know, we're all calculating all the time about, well, how much time are we spending with other people? And how much time is that indoors or outdoor? You know, it's all a grand calculation. So, okay, I'm not answering your question. I don't know. I'm not there yet. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
I'm not there yet.
So what I wonder about, I guess, is even if you open theaters, and even if you say, to try to satisfy the clientele, that we're going to observe distance, we're going to make sure this is as safe as we can make it, we're not going to put you next to anybody, and we're going to make great separation, and we're never going to go even as high as 50% of the potential seats. How do you make money? How do you make money out of that?
Good question, especially because the cruelest irony to me is that where theaters make their money, of course, is concessions.
Sure.
And when you bring concessions into the equation, then you get people taking masks off in order to eat and drink. And that was a deal breaker for us for that screening, because that would have been allowed in that room. And it's like, you know, no. So again, it's just everybody's coming to this in their own personal, making their own personal decisions. But to the how they make money, great question. I mean, I just think at this point they're just literally trying to stay alive, which is why it's so hard for me not to be, you know, like I am such a booster by nature. Like I
want
to
help.
Yeah,
you want them to do well.
Oh,
yes,
my God.
Sure.
I mean, I want to be one of the people that's helping. And I know that's exactly how Christopher Nolan feels, too. I mean, I'm not, like, I'm tough on him in this piece. And but, you know, I don't think he's out for, I think he's coming from a completely sincere place, you know, and I wish I could be like that, but I can't right now, you know.
So I got a note yesterday to prepare for this from Nigel that said there's a Wonder Woman movie coming out, a mm-hmm. James Bond movie coming out, a mm-hmm. Dune movie coming out. They're all going to open. Where are they going to open? Are they going to be on your TV or your computer? Or are they all going into theaters? Is there some rising tide that says, don't worry about it, we're all going into theaters now?
I don't think there's a rising tide. I don't sense that, at least. If we're talking about America, because I think the globe is a different... I mean, like, Tenet has done amazingly well around the globe, because there are lots of places where they just, it feels like the testing and the tracing and the protocols, and frankly, the compliance culture is higher,
right.
You know, like,
right.
I also worry about enforcement. I mean, I applaud the theaters for getting these, you know, these protocols in place, but I am not as confident in, I mean, I hate to say it, my fellow man, you know? those are all scheduled to open this fall, like between October and December. And right now, they're scheduled to open in theaters. But I think that's absolutely subject to what theaters are open. And which, you know, if they do continue to open and stay open. I mean, I think staying open is another X factor. And I hope that they can. And I hope we don't have, you know, I hope outbreaks don't cause them to close. But I feel like it's such a fluid situation right now that I don't think anybody can say with any degree of confidence that it's going to be this way in December for West Side Story to, you know, open all across the country in theaters. I just don't, like, who can say that with any kind of firm footing?
Well, welcome to the world that I have inhabited for the last 5 months in sports, which is the NFL season's going to open. That doesn't mean it's going 16 straight weeks. You know, baseball opened. That didn't mean the Marlins were playing 60 games as the original schedule intended. I mean, all of this happens in a fluid situation. Can I ask the one question that I'm West Side Story? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Who's making West Side Story? That's the greatest musical ever made in a movie. Well, who's making that?
I know. Oops, I'm sorry. The dog is mad as you are. it's a head scratcher. I'm sorry.
We love dogs here. Don't worry about it.
Homework, everybody. Working at home. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
A leaf just fell in Saskatchewan. That's my joke about this dog. It's Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner. And so that's, to me, an interesting, like, that is one interesting element to it that I feel like those guys.
They're my age. They've watched West Side Story. They know it's the best musical ever put on film.
I totally agree. Never remake something that's, like, you know. But
nuts.
But in terms of the cultural politics of it and the cultural representation of it, I think that there is room for updating and there is room for reframing and kind of reassessing. And I feel like Kushner, especially, I just want to see what they do with this material. I mean, I don't think that, honestly, I am kind of interested in what they'll do with it, to be clear. Like, I am not as reflexively anti. I mean, I think, like, okay, oh, we'll see what you got, because I love their collaborations. I think the two of them really bring, I don't know, they bring something out in each other that I think often results in something great.
Well, what are they going to do with it? They're going to put it on the moon with robots? I mean, you know, it's West Side Story. Come on.
I know. I guess I haven't. I mean, look, didn't they lip sync? I mean, Natalie Wood didn't sing in West Side Story.
No, No, she did not.
Right? I mean, there are little things they could do better. And she was, you know, I feel like with the casting and that kind of the authenticity of the singing, I'd like to see people really, you know, the real people do it. Never say never, Tony. Yeah, never say never. It could work. It might work.
Remember, are they going to try and recreate the dancing as well? Like, you can't improve upon cool.
The dancing was the greatest.
Well, no, but
do you know who was involved in that movie? Just so people understand who was involved in that movie and the show, because obviously it was a show first.
Right.
The music was by Leonard Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
The lyrics were by Stephen Sondheim.
I know.
The choreography was Jerome Robbins. These are the best people in America who ever did this.
But what's wrong with? I mean, we have revivals of those shows, including West Side Story, by the way.
Revivals are fine.
What makes this not a revival for a whole new audience?
I don't
see a problem. There's still the first movie will always exist. It's not going to erase the first movie from the books, but I don't think it's so wrong to have, especially with all of those principles, like you mentioned. Like, let's see what they do with those great elements and see if there's something new to be found. I mean,
dancers in that movie was Elliot Feld, who went out to become, you know, a great choreographer. William Shakespeare is rolling over in his grave on this.
But why? But we have so many movies of Shakespeare. Like, why not? Why not another interpretation of a great work? Like, why is that so threatening? I don't understand. Like, what do you think?
Because I'm old. I'm threatened because I'm old.
Well, then you don't.
And I've invested myself in the movie.
Just wait for his thoughts on Mulan.
I know. Somebody help me out here. There's got to be an example of a movie. Oh, I'll think of it once we hang up.
Tony,
it didn't necessarily improve upon, but you know that it's kind of like, oh, that's what you do with that.
The only movie like that that I thought was just about as good, was the Art Theft movie, the Thomas Crown Affair.
It was just
about as good. But I didn't see the need to do it, you know. Manchurian Candidate was dreadful.
Yeah, that was a
dreadful
bad idea.
Yeah. Okay.
We can think of more, but anywho.
Ocean's 11. That was a good remake, wasn't it?
Yes, thank you, Nigel. I like that. Yeah, I mean, I just feel like...
Yes.
But especially with a theater show, like if we think of it in terms of a revival, maybe that'll take the...
All right. Thank you, Anne.
I miss you so much.
Well, when movies come back. When movies come back and we can all see them.
We can talk about streaming movies.
I don't know how to stream... I don't know how to stream.
You don't know about the Netflix and the Amazon and the Hulu?
No, or the Hulu. No.
All right.
I don't belong. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Thanks,
Anne.
Thank you.
Anne Hornaday, boys and girls. We will take a break. We will come back with email and a jingle and a song by Joey the Jammer. Joe Arrow will have a song when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
A six gold toe, the kind you wear with boots that ain't the kind I need. You should have heard the old man talking off this pack of free socks. Everybody needs socks. In the summer, Tony doesn't wear socks. Hey, Michael, take these old man socks. And now apparently these socks are not a match for golf. So Jewish kitty ain't just gonna pawn them off. You're making me look bad, he says to Dr. Hoffwaff. But Tony can't believe that Michael won't accept a bunch of free socks. Unopened free socks.
Unopened.
In the summer, Tony doesn't wear socks. Carol told him they were old man socks.
That's just great. That's just great. Joe Arrow, just great. Makes me so happy. Nigel, you want to do Bethesda Bagels or you want Michael to do it? Because he stopped by again today.
Yes, how have the bagels been from Bethesda Bagels?
Bagels are fantastic, as they always are, and you can find these bagels at 4819, located in the heart of Bethesda, where it's a happening scene. Again, I get there 10 minutes before the doors open, and the place is just filled with people walking up and down the avenue.
Is that right? That's great. That about do it for today. For us, I can't even read anymore, but before we get to the mailbag, let me just say it's all right. It's okay, and you may look the other way. We can try to understand the New York Times don't take no ads. That's the beginning. It's Tony Manero, right? That's who John Travolta plays, Tony Manero. Do I have that name right? And he's walking with paint cans. paint cans. Thanks to our guests today, Chuck Culpepper and Ann Hornaday. Thanks as well to today's sponsor, Bespoke Post. And remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, radio.com. If you listen to the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. We're not going to have a show Memorial Day. We will take that holiday like everybody else, but we'll have shows later in the week next week. From Hampton Nager in Dallas, Texas, you never fail to surprise me. I never knew until you said so that caramel in your payday bar can be found in nature. All I can picture now is Carmelo Anthony standing in a kiddie pool after going 4-for-12 against the Nets while a farmer scrapes off residue with a trowel. Bon appetit. Throwing away the other Twix bar and not looking back, I am Hampton Nager, or Nager, in Dallas, Texas. From Dave Shelto in Glastonbury, Connecticut, listening to Wednesday's show, I just heard Tony say that he ate payday bars because they were all natural. I've been trying unsuccessfully to improve my diet by integrating more organic and natural foods lately.
Yep.
If Mr. Tony can direct me to where I can buy a caramel tree to plant next spring, that'd be greatly appreciated. So far, I've checked at Whole Foods, Agway, and the Home Depot, and have only been met by stares and rude comments. Maybe they're only grown in the hospitable climate of the DMV.
Amazon look, Fresh.
Look, peanuts exist in nature. Sugar exists in nature. You do something to sugar to make caramel. It's good, and it's good for you. It is. Paydays are great. Here's a long one. When you mentioned, this is from Ryan Mahan in Springfield, Illinois. When you mentioned you like open pit barbecue sauce on Wednesday, September 2nd, I had to text my wife, as I only know one other person whose preference is that strangely colored, kind of runny, but incredibly awesome stuff. By the way, there is another one. Peter Melman loves open pit.
Nothing burns like open pit.
My wife texted back that it's because, like you, I'm an old man. I'm 39, but I've got old expressions. I like old candy like cherry slices and Tootsie Rolls. The kinship is real. Also, I live a few hours south of Chicago, but people love their deep dish pizza here. It's the worst. But whenever I think of deep dish pizza, I can't help but think about a terrific rant Jon Stewart once had when he still hosted The Daily Show. The best parts of his long 2-minute rant are below. Deep dish pizza is not only better than New York pizza, is not only not better than New York pizza, it's not pizza. It's a casserole. I'm surprised you have not thought to complete your deep dish pizza by putting canned onion rings on top of it. This is tomato soup in a bread bowl. This is an above ground marinara swimming pool for rats. I want to know when I get drunk and pass out on my pizza that I'm not going to drown. This is great. This is great. I like Jon Stewart. He's right about everything that he says, obviously. From Steve the Sycophant. Your flaming barbecue story was almost at the level of my disaster last Sunday. My wife had whipped up a new marinade for some chicken thighs, and I put them on the barbie with all three burners on low. A few minutes later, vast quantities of smoke were pouring out. I raised the lid, and zoom, flames reached for the skies. Clearly figuring out that the drippings from the marinade were igniting, I removed the chicken for a minute, turned the burners to ultra low, and put the chicken back on, burnt side up. The result? I burned the hell out of the other side, too. As we munched away on very, very crisp chicken, I got the look from my lovely wife that all husbands know. Next time, fricasseed chicken. This is great. Hey, Toby, I haven't heard of you either. Call me when you win a slam. Best wishes, Marin Cilic. P.S., here's how I eat pizza. Make a fist with your left hand. Extend the middle finger on your left hand. Point left hand in the direction of the person who's telling me how to eat pizza. Take the right hand and eat the pizza. Look at my U.S. Open trophy. Sorry, you can't do that.
The email's the best. MarinChilichGrandSlam@gmail.com.
Just great. Mark in Gaithersburg wanted to share a story about John Thompson. Back in March of 1988, I was a month shy of turning 3 years old. My family lived in New Jersey, and my dad took me to a basketball game at his alma mater, Princeton. Because I was a strange child, I wore a Boston Celtics warm-up suit to the game. At some point, just the same age as Bootsy, basically. At some point during the game, my dad points out a very large man sitting in a row much closer to the court than ours and convinces me to go down and ask him for his autograph. So being an almost three-year-old, I do it. Not only do I do it, but I let this very large gentleman know why he is there that night by pointing to the court and telling him that's where they play basketball. The man picked me up, sat me down on his knee, and said something to the effect of, "Oh, really?" I don't think my dad knows exactly what he has said since he was probably in shock from embarrassment by that point. But he signed my game program, and off I went with a souvenir. Turns out that man was Big John Thompson, there to see his son play for Princeton that night. He must have been a pretty gentle giant to treat someone else as obnoxious child with such kindness, though I have to believe his response would have been different had I been wearing Lakers gear. That is a lovely, lovely story. If you're out on your bike tonight, as always, do wear white.
You know, they all get involved, and they all got their gear already, and so they're going to be all colored up in the maroon and black and yellow.
What a dope.